Wisdom is pouring out from
This little thing here is obviously
Rob
not connected
Barnaby.
to the power line.
Okay.
You have to be careful not to contact it when you put the cover back on.
So Rob Barnaby's explaining to us why you probably shouldn't screw your MSI covers on.
Yeah, something immediately goes wrong inside if you screw the cover on. Of course, you're supposed to unplug it before you take the cover off, but nobody ever does. You might power it down, but you don't unplug it. And this thing should have had a little plastic insulator over it. But or just been placed
surely.
Farther from the edge.
Absolutely right. Yep. So the MSI. So this is one of four MSIs we have, and all are missing front panel switches.
Well, I guess you could move them around and get three whole ones.
Just pop one back on. So the one at the Computer History Museum misses a switch as well. Wire app. This is I guess this is a multi-bus board.
Prototype board, yeah.
Yeah, prototype.
It's a different bus.
So I'm thinking if you did decide to donate your MSI, this would be the display area that I would have it running, etc.
Oh.
So I'd replace this MSI with an actual running.
Mine's more boring. It doesn't have all the switches.
Yeah, but it has a bigger story to tell.
It works.
It works.
You know, it's got a keyboard and a screen, unlike that one.
Unlike that.
You can actually edit a source file and presumably install some pilot. Yes. Yeah, you could do things with it.
Now here we have the rest of the boxes. Various color, shapes, sizes. This is an early Challenger. This is serial number 16.
Is what?
Serial number 16, which was modified, I guess. Show me that's like a boot sequence. And
seven-segment display.
Zilog system for prototyping the Z80, Z81 chips. So it's a Zilog machine, which are fairly unusual, I guess. The new Poly 88.
Yeah, and there was an Intel machine.
I have several
it was
upstairs.
Bigger than that.
Yeah, I got the blue box. I got
no,
the
one
lower.
$10,000 for it or something.
Yeah. It's Intel development. They're called IDS, Intel Development Systems.
Yeah, sure. We used one for some development in MSI. But once we developed a little software, of course, you could do everything the same in the MSI.
The MSI. And I always liked the Southwest technical products they made. Before the iMac, they made multicolor these terminals. You could get them in three colors.
Hmm. Okay. But still, it's a terminal.
Still, it's just a terminal. And the Kim over here. Various Kims. I cannot find, it's actually probably in that case, but the MOS Kim one. We've got about four Kims. We also have the rare Kim 4, which is an expansion, like a motherboard expansion thing.
Does that plug onto this?
It somehow plugs onto that.
That's your Edward Kim. I don't recognize that.
Commodore Kim. Commodore took them over and took over the MOS name.
Yeah, that's what I think of as a TRS-80.
A real, honest-to-God TRS-80. This came with the ultra-fancy stringy floppy wafer. See, floppy was in, tape was out. So it's just a floppy all strung out. See,
well,
it's not
a tape.
It's a
continuous loop tape cartridge.
But it's not a floppy. See, it's a stringy
no.
floppy.
No.
It's not a tape. It's a stringy floppy.
It's a marketing gimmick.
And the fully loaded modem, cassette, manuals. And Lee Felsenstein, of course, who designed this and who hosted Homebrew Club, he's written funny things on several of the machines here. I don't know what this refers to, but that's a Sol.
Yeah.
And supposedly they sold 10,000 of those, and it got the Jobs and Wozniak Steves up off their asses to get going because this was becoming a commercial success. And it had a nice format of keyboard, real computer in there.
And in that time frame, the Apple was the Apple One on an open board.
That's it. I wish I had one of those.
A little later.
Those are pretty rare.
I've only seen them once or twice at shows.
In 77, all in 1 year, this guy, and this guy. Right, all launched about the same time in 77. I guess the West Coast Computer Fair, which was, you know, a major big deal. And so the genius, well, this is Jeff Raskin, who's the father of the Macintosh project, but also worked at Apple very early on. This is the first joystick created for an Apple II. as a prototyping effort between him and Wozniak, and then the product that came out. So sort of a defamed red book built out of the Woz Wonder Book, which we was discarded. We found it. Bill Goldberg brought it over. It was a copy, and this is all of Wozniak's notes that were pulled from his filing cabinet and made into that red book. All his handwritten notes, because there was no manual that shipped with the Apple II, and so this became the manual, very unofficial kind of official manual. And we found the original of the source materials, and we scanned them, and this was done by David Craig. He beautifully restored it, and it's on the net.
It's at least games I typed to their manuals.
Yeah, and I presented a copy of this to Woz. We did Apple's 30th birthday party in 2006, and tears came to his eyes as he saw codes he hadn't seen in 30 years or so. But anyway, a weird one. Notice the sticker. Microsoft 1977 Albuquerque, New Mexico, yeah. Stuck onto a Apple cassette, then with AppleSoft stamped on top. So this is your archaeology. This was the shipping Microsoft BASIC for the Apple II before the cassette interface. So this is like linking the two companies, because they were still in Albuquerque at the time. They weren't in Seattle yet. So it's a very good piece. Of,
there's Microsoft was, yeah.
There's an image of this very cassette hanging in a museum in Albuquerque right now that I provided them a high-res scan of this. And then the cassette interface, Woz is designed for a cassette interface. I mean, a floppy interface, what am I saying? And the contemporary design for North Star for 1 5 1/4 floppy. Mm-hmm. This is Woz's design for 2 5 1/4 floppies.
Yeah. A lot more of it in software, presumably.
In software and using voltage, regulating voltage for the drive control instead of using a chipset. It's one of the things that he did. But this was insanely great and allowed them to be profitable and successful. Without this, this is just an expensive computer with a cassette, lousy cassette interface.
Well, engineers didn't understand that with simple software, your main processor waited while you're doing disk I.O.
Right.
So you might as well use it on a bit-by-bit or byte-by-byte basis to feed the drive and keep the hardware cost down.
Yeah.
IMSI's first floppy interface had another 8080 in it. It was a two-word thing. And they were so proud of this intelligent disk link. But there wasn't any software that would use the compute time while the main processor was waiting.
That's right. That's right.
Furthermore, when you've got a CRC error, when you're reading it, you couldn't get the data out of it. You couldn't try to do your own correction.
Right, because it was just sort of a daughter processor.
Yeah, well, they understood that. Their next generation disk interface used the main CPU and was much smaller and cheaper. And this is what I bought.
So,
you know, because CPM didn't give you any provision for running one fork while another one waited for the disk. You know, if you ask for a file read or write, you got the whole package and you didn't get control back until it was done. So it either succeeded or failed.
Did you have regular interface with Gary Kildall?
Yeah, I guess I had regular interface with
him. Like you were bugging him about this forking problem? Or it was somebody?
No, I thought we were stuck with that. I was telling IMSI, don't spend people's money on hardware they can't use. You know, like you sold a megabyte micro advertised?
Megabyte micro.
No, see, you've never even heard of it.
Mm-mm.
They made the beautiful hardware memory bank swapping thing so you could put a megabyte of memory into an 8080. But there wasn't any software that you'd use it.
Oh, boy.
You know, CPM would run a 60, would use 64K, which didn't require any special hardware. But
right.
By the time in question, and that's what people bought.
So you'd have to use some sort of
weird, we're running as little as 16K.
Weird bank switching thing to get at that megabyte.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, that might work if you provided an operating system for it. Did the whole operating thing and some support to the application programs.
Right.
But they had a hardware guy that didn't understand software showing the thing at a show, I remember, and that's the last time I ever saw it.
Okay.
But I saw something about it on the internet or something. I was browsing to come up here. It popped up recently. I don't think it was a computer history museum.
What's interesting is when I started this project, I started this project in '87 and was collecting memorabilia and a lot of it Xerox oriented. because we were working with Xerox. And then in 98, I bought this farm, and this is when this got going. And we, our site was one of the only ones, the only website about computing history. Now there's a lot, and it's really heartening to see it, that things like this megabyte.
Yeah, the stuff is disappearing.
Yeah.
You grab it while you can.
People are starting to put together their sites and do good quality video, and it's starting. So the next sort of, believe it or not, this particular Apple III is running CPM and the Apple III DOS, both.
I remember you, there was a time you could get a CPM card for an Apple II.
And this has...
You put a Z80 into the Apple II.
Right.
It just stopped the original processor.
Right.
But you can run CPM software. I'm not familiar with an Apple III.
Apple III was a failure. It was business-oriented and had a lot of problems. But Apple's...
And then there was a Lisa that didn't go very far.
And here's the Lisa. And this is a very special Lisa because this is a development system from Apple itself where it was in the transition between the Twiggy floppy, which was this Fileware floppy, which you read from both sides. See, look at this. And the 3.5-inch. So Steve Jobs actually came back, speaking of Steve launching the iPhone 2 today, he came back from Japan about 3 months into the production of the Lisa, which had two floppies, two of those floppies, and pulled this out of his shirt pocket, 3.5-inch floppy, and said, stop production, we're converting to this. And that was one of the nails in the coffin for the Lisa, as well as the fact it was about a $12,000 to $15,000 purchase.
Yeah, I still remember 9,000, which I suppose was the smallest.
Yeah, that was your...
Yeah, just didn't.
So they put a hard drive in it, and a hard drive in a 3.5-inch. But, yeah, that's a Lisa in transition. And we're still not finished this display, I see here. But anyway, BBC Micro and the British, the Acorn Electron, Archimedes, British systems with the very British plug, which they still use to this day.
I've seen those.
Yeah, that's a Brit power.
Yeah. And part of the theory of it is, instead of having lots of 15 or 20 ampere branch circuits, they have a 15 amp circuit, 220 circuit.
That's right.
That surrounds your entire house. So the plug has to be safe with 50 amps flowing through it.
And,
right in there, there's usually
And the consumers had to assemble the freaking plugs themselves. If you remember the film Brazil, you know, it shows you, like, the guy wakes up out of bed and he has a phone switch with patch cords next to his bed, so as his phone starts ringing, he has to patch it in. And it was all about British technology gone amok. But
seeing one of these on a camcorder charger amazed me. You know, something that recharged a couple of double A's or something.
Right.
But it has to have a plug like that.
And 1982, in the same 12-month period, Osborne 1 and the Grid Compass came out. And this was like the machine of the future for $9,000. Clamshell laptop, big plasma screen, built-in ROM operating systems, power supply and modem built-in. And this kind of a keyboard.
The machine of the future for $9,000.
The generals could buy.
No disk?
No disk. It was flash ROM and an external. And then Osborne 1 with these rare external external monitors. Yeah, for 18.
Oh, so it's closed. It's lopsided. Okay. Well, I think of those as the slanted suitcase thing.
And this bloody ribbon cable getting in the way of your WordStar. You know, because, of course, WordStar, this one has stopped working, but I used to demo this all the time with WordStar on that screen. It's a real trip.
How many columns do they put in that screen? Well, I suppose it's switchable.
I think it's switchable. But, and here we have the pride and joy of the first truly powerful, big-screen, portable WordStar machine, the K-Pro. This is the K-Pro 2. K-Pro's numbering system was odd.
Yeah,
threes came before ones and twos.
Moderate pricing, wasn't it?
Yeah, and they were directly competing with Osborne didn't last for very long for various reasons.
It seems like Compaq displaced them.
Yeah, in fact, IBM PC-DOS displaced everybody to the grave, I guess.
Maybe, perhaps Compaq made the portable.
But look at this beautiful template. Here, can you hold, it up?
I couldn't remember all those commands.
Control K, Control Q, right? Control
K, Control... Abandoning your edit.
Right.
That's quit.
That's quit.
The second one is mnemonic, and the first was.
You know what? This is a. This will be a. Actually, I probably have the. Should have the flash on.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah,
you've got a lot of pictures that on my monitor look underexposed.
Ah, okay.
On my laptop, and maybe it's the adjustment of my screen.
Time for flash.
Very dark. The thing is, on a computer, you always have a white background, or usually have a white. If there's anything else in the screen, there's a white background, so pictures need to be light to look pretty good.
Okay, hold it up, and we'll get a, we'll okay. get a, the caper on the background.
Cursor diamond shown here.
Oh, the cursor diamond. So somebody made this beautiful template and then modded it.
Somebody at Processor Tech, to my knowledge, invented, they had the cursor motion on WASZ.
Okay.
Which seemed nice because spatially they represent the direction you're going.
Mm-hmm.
And it was my idea to move it over one to ESDX so that you could use... If Control S goes back, goes left one character, Control A goes left a word.
Gotcha.
And Control D goes forward a correct character, and Control F. But the basic diamond, spatially mnemonic idea, I got from the manual of one of these.
Ah. Okay, point to that, because that'll give us a
reference. Here's the original cursor diamond on the W, A, S, and Z keys.
Okay. That's the source of the original cursor diamond.
And that's where I got it. I don't know how it evolved to get there. It's just that's something I managed to get documentation on.
Okay, that will help.
Okay, I had a friend who was writing for them.
So, wonderful.
And the last place I've seen that is the IDE, Integrated Development Environment, for the Borland software used let you choose classic keystrokes.
Oh, classic. And,
had the word star.
I had the word
star. That was the last thing I could edit on before I had to use the, learn to use the down arrow keys.
Of course, I've got to get a picture of you with the M sign in the background.
Oh, okay.
Make it completely complete. So here, this tells a story. Well, that's the first hard drives. People don't realize
first hard, hard drives for microcomputers.
5 megabyte. Quantum, yeah, for microcomputers. And this is the machine.
Gary Kildall had an 80 megabyte hard drive sitting there. Oh, my God. Somebody was working on it.
This is the QDOS machine. This is Patterson's ripoff of CPM on the Seattle Computer Products Gazelle.
Okay.
1980 or so. So this is the machine that SCP wrote their ripoff of CPM, which then became DOS.
Oh, the Seattle?
Seattle Computer Products, SCP-DOS.
Okay.
Yeah, or known as QDOS for Quick and Dirty Operating System.
Okay. Yeah, it was more like 8-bit CPM than 16-bit CPM was.
Yeah.
But the other rumor I've heard is that Gary Kildall didn't like the idea of dealing with IBM or something, and they
right.
needed to see him once, and he spent the day flying around within his airplane, keeping them waiting.
Yeah, and the IBM, but, the IBM guys presented their non-disclosure agreement, and the folks at the company, the lawyer, their attorney from Monterey or something, through, sort of like wouldn't talk to them because it basically said, "We're IBM, and anything you show us, we own."
Okay.
You know, one of those kinds of things.
Yeah, forget.
So IBM 5100. This is actually 5110, but IBM's entree into microcomputing was the 5100 in 1975, same year as the Altair, but this is an IBM version. It has a big cabinet underneath, and this is for a tape cassette.
Mm-hmm.
And the 5100 and 5110 supported BASIC and APL. So it gives you an idea. I mean, who would...
I was unaware of those things as far as I can remember at the time. Some contact with APL, but I think it was some time-sharing machines.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, APL was sort of a bigger What's machine.
Interesting. I was to find out about the market for old micros. Earlier this month, I was looking at eBay, and I saw an IBM 5110. Somebody was selling one. I was thinking, what was that thing? How come I never heard of it before?
Yeah, and it was because it was $15,000 and sold in corporate channels.
Yeah, it didn't get into a hacker market.
No hacker market. In fact, this is the 5120, the very last personal computer that IBM built itself. 1978, 79, and since didn't build a single machine itself in the microcomputer market, to outsource, you know, without, this is 100% IBM except for the CRT, and that's another story. But of course, everything was building off on the, this is our only piece of a mainframe here, the actual System 370 nameplate, and the, I used this actually to, when I did 370 assembler in college.
I never did.
Not 360,
All
but.
base registers and stuff.
Oh, okay. So we jump from
But
1979.
86 assembler struck me as remarkably unattractive.
Yeah. I like the DEC, you know, architecture. I thought that was cool. The instruction
Yeah.
architecture on
Well, I
DEC.
like the PDB-10s.
Yeah.
I never did 11. I did one, I think, a bit of 15.
And the PDP-12 was a combination of a link. It was a link and a PDP together in the same machine.
Oh, like in a PDP-8?
Yeah.
Sounds like it would have been a PDP-8 size
It
machine
was
anyway.
totally weird.
The 10 was a maneuver, an upgrade of the 6, a 36-bit word machine. Very nice, elegant instruction set.
Yes.
It would address a quarter of a million words, and nobody.
Nobody.
What would you need a quarter of a million words for? Except at Project Mac at MIT, they had a program for reformatting a DEC tape. The way it works is very simple. It read the entire tape into the RAM,
Right.
into the core, and
Okay.
then wrote it back on the same tape in the other format.
Wow.
Because they held, 80K words or something, and Project Mac at MIT actually
Had
had the full memory
a
on those things.
cabinet. They had the full memory.
Now, at BBN, we had one of the 64K, and you could sit there in the debugger and type in a little program that would make it zero a quarter of a million words. And you could go to
Okay.
another terminal and do that and go to another, and
Wow.
they'd all run. It'd just go slower and slower because they were
Right.
swapping. They were running a quarter of
You
a
could
million words of virtual memory.
do pure testing at the OS level of strategies for time sharing. Actually.
I think the only strategy that really worked, I know I lost kind of lost touch with this, but then the only really was having enough core so all your users were in core all the time. All this shit about optimizing your swapping.
Yeah.
Like you, when somebody hits enter and the program becomes ready to run, if several people have done that, you give them all a few milliseconds, and then the ones that haven't blocked again, you give a few more milliseconds. So the people that are doing editing or something, of course, with very little processing, do the best, get the best response, and the people
Response.
that are compiling just sink down to the background. And if there are a lot of people editing, then while you're or you're getting compiled, then you go out to lunch.
And we find out that
But
the closed door button that Otis puts on their elevators really doesn't do anything.
well, I talked to an elevator serviceman once, and he said one of the standard things they always did was disconnected that button. Because all it did was created problems where the door closes when somebody involved doesn't want it to.
Right. So IBM PC, this one has been souped up with a hard drive, aftermarket,
Oh.
and Charlie Chaplin.
I see. Yeah, I guess it would say XT on the plate if it was
That's
XT
right. I
original.
still don't have an actual pure XT, and my father used one, and they gave it away. I would have loved to have
Yeah,
his.
XT. My recollection is the XT looked like that.
Yeah, they look very similar. I mean, they're within 2 years of each other. And
XT
then
was the.
I worked at IBM in research when this was in development. It was called the Big Top, and the nameplate had these little tents on it. I remember that. That was the code name for it. And they used to take it on commercial airline flights. You had to pack it into a weird suitcase with like weird shapes, kind of like when they do test cars, you know, GM, where they put odd stuff on the outsides of their on their test cars on the track so that people can't
Oh,
figure out the
like
real
the desert,
shape.
yeah.
They would do the same thing that someone had to carry it on their lap because it was a prototype and it could never be seen by the by anybody in public.
I had one looked just about like that. But it was made somewhere in Southeast Asia, and it came from a guy in South San Francisco that had found it in some little newspaper.
Oh.
Yeah, I remember one of the things he said, he kept being mystified by, how come every time he fires up a new motherboard, it has tomorrow's date in it? Oh, it was last fired up on the other side of the date line.
The date one.
And the battery was good enough so it still had the date.
One.
But yeah.
PC Junior with wireless
But
chip
that and
within.
mine ran 8 megahertz when an AT ran 6 megahertz.
Ah.
But
Chiclet keyboard. The research lab I worked at IBM in 83, I remember going to the cafeteria, which was shared with the manufacturing plant, and the engineers were talking about this keyboard they were making and saying it was a piece of shit and that was never going to use it. You know, this was, they did this keyboard for the PC Junior to dumb it down so it wouldn't impact sales of this machine. And then later, of course, they were forced to come with a real keyboard.
It never went a lit far, did it?
It always sold it. I mean, Apple thought this was their doom. Hmm. There was this terror inside of Apple.
Minor interrupt. To my knowledge, this is the real shape of the keyboard.
Oh, the Commodore PETS keyboard.
Yeah, well, they're laid out in squares.
Yeah, and of course, it's usable by someone 3 years and younger. But
yeah, it's sensible layout, but we're used to having keys offset like this.
Yeah.
But that of course, comes from mechanical typewriters.
Right.
From having the keys evenly spaced. I don't think there's any ergonomic reason to have keyboards be that way anymore, except we're used to them.
Well, here we are walking along here. The first supposedly 100% PC compatible clone, the Eagle PC from Los Gatos, which when the day they went published, the founder tipped his car into the Lexington Reservoir off Highway 17 and died, and the company then went down later on. But in fact, his daughter sent us the full story of her father, and it's now up on the site.
Did you teach him to swim?
Well, when you pancake a Lamborghini,
that was probably more complicated than that. But I mean, I always wonder why Ted Kennedy couldn't save that girl's life.
So. Something to do with maybe not wanting to get his tweed.
There may have been a lot of current, and he was drunk, but I don't know. And I grew up around water.
A compact.
Mm-hmm.
Now you guys must have when these clones were coming out. I mean, WordStar was presumably being ported. Was ported to DOS from CPM, and then it was being pulled.
Yeah, I wasn't doing it by then.
You weren't doing it by then.
What happened? No, he got some company in Ireland. No, MicroPro had a lab in Ireland. They had five people working in that or something. And there were
early offshoring.
Yeah. Their orders were to make it do exactly what it did and no more, and I thought it was amazing how with a more powerful computer they couldn't make a more powerful product.
Well, code got bloated, right? Presumably the code got bigger and bigger to fill up that more powerful computer.
The computers get bigger and bigger. It doesn't matter if the code gets somewhat bigger and bigger.
But
it was still an assembler. Oh, and then there was another program that had them do, and then Diane... They worked on it for weeks and weeks, and then he gave it to Diane Hedzicek, and Diane Hedzicek converted it to the IBM in a weekend. And she was the gay programmer that I hired it in. And I think at that point they let the group in Ireland go. You know, it's like you take one person that's a little bit smarter, and sometimes they're 5 or 10 times as productive in computer stuff.
Believe it or not, there's a fellow who worked at Compaq for about 10 years. Who was the CIO of Compaq, is sending his original pristine model in the next week or so. So we're going to get that. But this is an original brochure. And, of course, they're all from House of Pies restaurant in Houston where they drew it all out on a napkin. One of the most famous business plans in history.
Okay.
And
they jumped an IBM's bandwagon.
This would have been another machine that would have run WordStar, Kromenko. That's the Kromenko C10 all-in-one, supposedly the first all-in-one. With the CPU. Well, it's the CPU and everything underneath the terminal.
Oh, yeah.
So it was like some of the weirder machines had the CPU and the keyboard, you know, great big keyboard.
No, the Trash 80.
Oh, yeah, the Trash 80 is the keyboard. Of course, we jump forward to the insanely great machine of 1989, the next cube. And what we did was this is the original poster from the launch, and we just sort of set up, these are practically new, that's actually brand new out of the box. We set them up just as the poster showed it.
Oh,
it was a kind of cool display.
That must be a laser printer.
That's a laser printer, Canon laser printer. Running PostScript. And,
okay.
There's your motherboard.
Another uselessness. You know, to remember... Seeing a Windows laser printer advertised?
Yeah.
You know, instead of having PostScript in the printer, they had a hairy driver.
Right.
And it cost, you know, 2/3 as much or something.
Right, right.
But, you know, once you realized the importance of the operating system and stuck to a limited number of ones of them, you didn't need all that extra hardware.
Right, and what was interesting for me is watching the gradual melting of custom hardware. Like here on the, this is the 68030 board, or the 40 board, for the next cube. You know, dedicated digital signal processors and stuff. And all of this melted away into the operating system. Bing, bing, bing. You know, that the operating system was doing all those functions. So the custom hardware is melting away.
At this point, I don't know what's in a modern soundboard, but it amazes me that I can run multiple computer programs simultaneously in my cheap old laptop, and then you get the sound mixed out of both of them.
Yeah.
I mean, you can play iTunes or something. And,
Mr. Jobs.
And I honestly don't know what's going on inside it.
Mr. Jobs at 29 or something. Well, this is when he was chairman of CEO founder of Next.
Oh.
So that would have been, yeah.
And he upgraded his clothing? He
upgraded to turtlenecks.
And then downgraded it when he came back.
Actually, I don't know what he was doing.
So a few years later, Apple came out with a smaller cube.
Yeah, in fact, there's another one in the other room.
Okay.
Now, when Apple was unable to get a decent multitasking operating system, you know, he had taken people out of the company to do the OS for that, which was a multitasking Unix kernel-based machine. Mm-hmm. A guy named Jean-Louis Gasset took a team and made the BOS on mm-hmm. a dual processor machine. This is the dual light pipes. That's a prototype. This is a finished one of the B-Box. And these were contenders for Apple's next OS later on in the 90s. Of course, we know who got it. But and so this machine, of course, which was preemptive multitasking, it was basically Windows 3.1. I mean, the Mac OS, preemptive multitasking, but cheap enough and just good enough. And, of course, with the laser printer. At,
software, I understand, somewhat ahead of the computer power.
The rare Mac Cracker, which allows you to crack the robot-assembled case without totally destroying it and disfiguring it. And, of course, you have to use the custom warranty-voiding screwdriver to open up your Mac, because that voided, because it was a closed box.
Yeah.
And this
did
is...
Did it take one this long? I mean, you can buy those at the hardware store in a normal
It wasn't
life.
Quite. It was
now
sort
it
of, you kind of went in here, right to about here.
So maybe you did need that.
Maybe you did need that.
That's a world I've never been much in touch with.
This was a hat worn by the dozen or so people who worked on the Mac.
The Mac stuff.
The Mac stuff, yeah.
I mean, inside it seemed clear. If you're going to write software, what you want is market, and that meant 8080.
Right.
I never even coded for the Z80.
Or the 6502.
No.
Yeah.
No, because the 8080 code would run the Z80 and double its speed.
Right.
It wouldn't speed up as much as if you used the additional instructions.
Gotcha.
But it was portable. You know, like WordStar had all the commands on control characters because all terminals had that.
Right.
All terminals would send all ASCII.
Yeah, all terminals would send all ASCII.
And everyone had different arrow keys on it, ones that sent different codes.
Right. The Control H, I remember, would send. Yeah, Control H was on the.
One common one was these four.
For the arrows.
Yeah.
So Control H, J,
which I
K,
used
and
earlier. Because ABM3 had little arrows on those keys.
On the VT100,
ABM3, yeah.
Yeah, the VT100 had I can't even remember. I programmed for that, for the arrow keys. Yeah, Tandy RaiderSnack Model 2, this machine here was used to help start Microsoft Press. And so Microsoft's books were written on Trash 80s.
Oh, was the only thing I could buy a bunch of?
You're running scripts at, no, because it was sort of a good system. Running scripts at, which was a highly regarded, editing
runoff
system.
Runoff program?
Yeah, kind of like a program. Runoff. Yeah, runoff. And these are some good.
Never seen that.
Hmm?
Never seen that.
Oh, the Holer soft? Yes. Yeah,
I mean, the picture submitter. That's off the regular Holer.
Stuart Brand, I mean, he really, from the Whole Earth to the Whole Earth Software, the whole Software Earth catalog.
So it's something you'd need to update every year or two.
Organizing MicroPro. Let's find, here, you want to find MicroPro in there. They got a whole bunch of products in there. So MicroPro's years were like 78, 79 to
78, I think, was probably the first introductions in the fall.
Right.
I have the paperwork from buying my Insight, and it was in this. When it was in 78, yeah, in the spring.
78 in the spring.
Yeah.
So in time for the West Coast Computer Fair, you think? Were they doing some announcements there? 79.
Some, the West Coast Computer Fair or
some such
fair. Because I think I went to Texas, and then I went to New York to go to a computer fair.
Oh, writing. Word processor spelling 46. Let's see if that's got to be there.
Where are we dating from here?
Page 46.
Yeah, no, I'm looking
for from the index.
Date, but I'm not finding it easily. No, I'm just looking for your copyright date.
Oh, this is probably like 84. So it would have been, this is sort of later. Oh, Stuart.
Yeah, WordStar 495, new word. That was a copy of WordStar. Perfect writer. Would have been word plus punctuation. Yeah.
Peachtree Press. And there's Stuart himself making some comment about what he uses, probably.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he looks exactly the same today.
Okay.
WordStar.
Top of the list.
Where starts the
for
top of
it? It's more than halfway down the list for IBM PC compatible.
Mm-hmm.
That puts it into the 80s.
Into the 80s. Oh, look at, we have one of those upstairs, a Wolverine toy computer, toy adding machine, 1940s. It's probably what Stuart Brand started off as when he was a kid or something, or
here
teenager.
84.
Yeah, 84, because they talk about Macintosh software in there. So the rest of this room is kind of, this is prototypes of the Apple IIc, prototype of the Macintosh Portable. A lot of Apple employees who took stuff home brought it here. Because technically mm-hmm. Apple destroyed all these prototypes, but I've got probably one of the largest collections of them now. Mm-hmm. The first commercial... Yeah, that was a test unit, too, so you never know what they were doing to that. Jeff Raskin's Canon Cat. And this is interesting. This is a portable music computer made out of an Apple II put into a suitcase by Daniel Kottke with a music keyboard attached to the side and an adapter board. That is the oldest Macintosh part in the world. This is a little CRT that was, Jeff Raskin bought about 12 of them in late 79 to start the Macintosh project. And then Daniel dumpster dived for this one and built this portable music computer
mm-hmm.
in 1980. So this is probably the great-grandfather of the iPod, the lost. But you could compose music on the keyboard, store it on the floppy, change the pitch and stuff here, and then play it back from this off of floppies. So really a kind of a cool thing.
One of the development pieces of that must have been the standard interface.
Yeah, and it was just junk parts from Apple. That Daniel was really early at Apple, and he just probably built this at home. But so this is the lineage room, but there is more.
There is more.
We go up through this is the tunnel of T-shirts. Turn the light on here. T-shirts being the symbol of everything and.
Cobalt T-shirt there. That sure didn't make the transfer.
No, here's.
I got a Cobalt compiler for the MSI once.
For the MSI?
It didn't take off.
Oh, I forgot to show you. We had an original T-shirt from the Atlantic Personal Computer Show. Original People's Computer Company T-shirt from Menlo Park. That was the Learning Center, run by Bob Albrecht and his partner. And
was it a Teach People to Use Computers?
Teach People from 1972. Really early on.
Oh.
The Xerox Alto, the machine where everything started. Well, what I like to do is to tell people the story that in the same week, in the first week of March 1975, Xerox opened the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, the new building at Coyote Hill Road. But at the same time as that building opened, because when that building opened, they were able to develop all of this whole thing out. The same week, Gordon French had the Homebrew Computer Club meeting in his garage over in Menlo Park. And so what you had was you had two communities come together. One, the hobbies community, which ended up building the hardware and the companies.
Mm-hmm.
And you had the Xerox people who built all the applications because this is the first modern machine right here.
It had fonts. And a lot of the people that were there came from the part of BBN I was in the late 60s.
Okay, they were founding. Bob Taylor would have recruited
them, right?
Yeah, they were
just like living well with good funding. The most of the stuff they did
cafeteria,
was
yeah. But, so they got to have fun
from the hobbyist market.
Fun with the Alto, and One of them might have been Dave Boggs. Well, actually, he was probably younger than that, but he co-invented Ethernet, and this is his connection to the ether from part. It's torn out of the ceiling. And this is supposedly some kind of cable TV part that they used on the early Ethernet.
Okay, it actually went, it was on the air rather than on a cable.
Oh, no, it was...
Oh, no, this is...
This is the cable. This is the There's a cable. Some kind of a knife that plunges in and makes contact with the... Something's over there. But this is these are all early Xerox machines. This is the Xerox Dolphin. This is the first machine that ran what was called the Mesa architecture. And it evolved into the Xerox Star, which was, like the Lisa, expensive, and you had to buy a whole network, and it was only sold to corporations and government. But it had the folders and icons and trash bins on it and the whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're under the impression that's where Apple's. Stuff Apple and Microsoft fought over really came from Xerox,
it
so I never
Xerox.
Heard that they were fighting.
In fact, this is the Macintosh business plan from July 1981, written in secret on Alto.
Okay.
Because they could make, Steve had seen the Alto and liked it, but he didn't like, the person who wrote it was Johanna Hoffman, and he wanted it to show pull-down menus and stuff, and to show graphics like this, but they couldn't do it on an Apple. And so she snuck into Park and wrote it on the Alto in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. So it was a proprietary business plan written in someone else's corporate research lab on their laser printer, which they had, and their network. And look at the different platforms and the launch years, 1982. They missed that by 4 years, 2 years rather. But anyway, so this is, if this had come out in public, it would have probably led to Apple having an injunction against it to use user interface ideas.
I never heard of the Xerox fought it, though.
Eventually,
the
Xerox...
The ideas should have been obvious.
And the people who left and joined the teams. Xerox eventually fought it, but it was thrown out. Because Xerox hadn't sought to protect the inventions. And you couldn't patent software in those days, too. So it was kind of the nebulous gray area between copyright and...
So that there may have been a statute of limitation issue.
There kind of was. And the judges basically in the 80s, federal judges threw it all out. All the trash bin, you know, the trash bin lawsuits.
Is this the Alto?
That's the Alto. So you had these removable disk platters.
Those?
There they are. Those are actually alignment platters. I don't actually have any media, but this machine spins a platter, and that says a lot. It'll spin a platter. Mm-hmm. And over here we have.
Yeah, it's not very useful.
The works. This is called.
Pretty much all useful machines have disks in them.
And these are Xerox Daybreaks, or 6085s, which is a working network, and that has the radar folder and icon thing of the star and the first. Touch mouse 1980. This, you won't believe this. This machine runs CPM. This is a CPM in a Xerox machine with 8-inch floppies and a WYSIWYG user interface.
A WYSIWYG user interface.
Tied to daisy wheel printing. But it was WYSIWYG in that you did actually see the type font and the style in the document, and it was black on white. It wasn't a really complex thing like the Macintosh, but it was 1980. And it was kind of WYSIWYG for the Diablo.
A little bit of a side. I like the black on white.
Yeah.
I don't have the monitor I had. You know, like I said, I had two development systems.
Yeah.
The other one, I put an inverter in the video so that it showed black and white. I mean,
gotcha.
It just took a couple of blue wires on the
board.
So
you just inverted it.
Yeah, I just inverted it.
So... The class of machines known as workstations.
You have to make sure it overscans. That's one of the reasons.
Gotcha.
And so you get some white margin.
And you could get a little bit of burn-in if you weren't careful, probably. More burn-in faster.
Yeah, well, you don't turn it up bright. If the sun hits it, you move it so the sun doesn't hit it.
Well, the rest of this room is devoted. This is the now extinct class of machines known as workstations, which no longer exist.
You said this did a WYSIWYG.
This is WYSIWYG.
That WYSIWYG application or WYSIWYG CPM?
Well, it was.
This much.
The editor was not WordStar. It was something Xerox wrote.
Yeah. My suspicion was they wrote an editor, and when you went back to CPM, you got an A prompt.
Yeah. They wrote some.
WYSIWYG CPM.
But it was beloved. I mean, these things cost 10 grand, but they were beloved by secretaries, and it was like the ultimate machine. I mean, and it connected to a file system, a network file system, because it was Xerox. But this was not the Star or the Alto that was a completely separate thing based on CPM. So this is one of the most exotic CPM machines that ever came out of CPM. Mm-hmm. And this one runs.
Okay.
We got video of this running. I carried this from Canada in my motorhome mm-hmm. with Galen saying, are you sure it's safe to have that thing up above our heads? Mm-hmm. But it was. It was a beautiful shape. And
it made it.
The guy had taken care of it. And it runs. It draws 8 amps.
It's tied to daisy
printing. Yeah, tied to daisy wheel printing.
Yeah, we're starting with the right driver and it would daisy print.
Yeah.
And well, one of the choices with daisy printers was whether you got the one with the serial interface that was easier to work with, or the OEM one for about 2/3 as much.
Right.
Yeah, that had a whole lot of wires and it required complicated programming.
Right.
But you could put the right drivers in your WordStar or in your BIOS.
And a supposedly, electric pencil. This is a story that was told by Bill Goldberg. The only way to run electric pencil's printer was to exit, like just leave electric pencil running, go in and load the print driver, and then go to get the spool and get the print on a Sol 20. So that was the early driver jockeying.
Yeah, but it would. That beat by a couple of years. WordStar and CPM.
Yeah,
electric pencil. Less memory. Yeah.
Yeah. Deck Rainbow running CPM. Now, this is supposedly running a multi-login session version of CPM where you could log in user accounts with shared and non-shared file space.
That's
on that one.
My only contact with that is Joel said he worked on one. Joel's the man I live with now.
You know,
I met in 2003.
Ask him about
He said they had a multi-terminal CPM system, and I wondered if you knew what he was talking about.
Oh, you know what it was? It was MPM for the Altos. Altos, and there's I'll show it to you downstairs.
Altos Z80 or Z80 machine?
Yeah, and they had multiple terminals on one. MPM, it was called.
Okay.
Anyway, documentation. Yeah. This just came in. This is a 1989 Personal Iris, which was one of the first small SGIs. The black box. And I'm collecting a limited number of these kind of Unix workstations because they're not all that historical yet. They're too new.
Okay.
But
it's time to get them.
Time to get them.
I should thank them for being replaced.
And in here, this is also back in your world. Well, your world spans such a long period of time, it's hard to determine where it ends and where it finishes. Or has it not finished? And in fact, here's Carl Helmer, I'm going to get him to sign. I see him at the microcomputer, Silmar. This is the best of Byte in the first 3 years. Mm. The best articles in Byte.
Where does 3 years get you?
What's in the video?
He's okay.
Yeah. Oh.
Build a fast cassette every place.
It was all about building things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mystery keyboards. You got a keyboard, someone, Kremenko Dazzler. Huh?
Oh, yes.
More
graphics than.
LSI 11 from DEC.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't have an Altair 680.
Do you think you ever get done with those? Do they have an operating system on them?
I don't think so. Dr. Robert Suding. Who created the Digital Group machines, which is this one down here, which looks like a DEC, but it's a microcomputer.
Okay.
And that is a high-speed cassette interface right there with a hierarchical file structure, if you can believe that.
Yeah.
On turning around.
Sure, I don't want to wait for it.
Our Intel Blue Box is not out here because this thing's so damn heavy, but this is an Intel development system. Here's another Intel development system. Okay. This one was used to microcode the tokamak fusion reactor at Columbia University. And the guy that donated it said, can you believe New Yorkers had a fusion nuclear reactor right in their midst and they didn't know it? Still don't. And the famous Adam family computer built by the Cabbage Patch Dolls people who made a fortune there and then blew it on this one. And various other machines. This is the Xerox 820, which has the CPU and the keyboard. And the Pongs. And Al Alcorn was here a couple of, 3-4 months ago. Actually, 2 months ago, the inventor of Pong. It was cool. And, of course, the Atari 400 with Space Invaders. If you remember the Woody Allen film Sleeper, when the Volkswagen Beetle, they go into a cave and it's like 1,000 years in the future.
Oh.
And there's a Volkswagen Beetle and it starts. Right, because that was the whole thing. This is the computer that will start and run in 1,000 years probably still, because
okay.
Built like a tank. And, you know, no moving parts, just boom, running space.
I think I just figured out what to do with something else I have.
Mm-hmm.
There's an Atari game that hooks to your TV set that's in my apartment in San Francisco.
Oh.
I believe it's still there.
Sure.
Take it to the Goodwill.
Absolutely. Which
I never
one?
I haven't played much with it. It belonged to a man I saw in the 80s who died in 1992. But it plays Breakout.
Oh, Breakout.
I'm not sure what else.
In fact, that was one of the first games on the
Atari. They're fairly rather.
These are our
first Space Invaders. You can play them on MSI.
Right. This is is that one? Oh, it's missing. It's got to be missing a switch. Hallelujah! It's not missing any front switches. Okay, and it's a very basic. It's a basic MSI with the white Rev-A CPU. Is that the 8080 white one? White ceramic. I mean, I've been.
It doesn't say anything to me.
This is Intel. Yeah, that's 8080 Rev A.
Okay.
That's
an
very, very early. Yeah, that's an early.
It has the fan.
It has the fan.
If you're going to run the one with all the boards in it, you ought to move the fan.
Oh, okay.
Or just leave it with the top off.
Or leave the top off.
So it ventilates well.
TV typewriter cookbook. Over here, one of the few things from the late 90s, the Audrey web appliance. Which was supposed to be like Judy Jetson's computer for her kitchen.
Okay.
And this is a Miko, Macintosh Inside, King Outside, by the King Kiosk Company. It's a touch screen Mac. And this is what I call, what we call here, the beige invasion, the 80s beige invasion, where everything went beige.
Yeah.
Except for the odd silver thing.
Yeah, well, did IBM cue all of that?
I think probably.
I mean, the color, this one doesn't have a cover, but the color of these was quite deliberately IBM blue.
IBM blue, yeah, and of course.
Look at the cover of the one downstairs.
Yeah. Yeah.
They went to the paint shop and looked at colors and tried to get one that looked like IBM blue.
That one there.
I think that's a little brighter.
And then, Challenger was, well, I think that beige signifies the office desk. I guess because offices used,
yep.
Desks used to be gray in the 50s and 60s, and then they switched
to
beige. And the Mindset with bubble memory module. This was a 68,000 based video editing system.
Do you remember bubble memory?
Bubble memory.
You know, it was something that chips were available for. People talked about what it would be good for.
And it was
I guess
you?
It's kind of the same thing as what flash memory does.
It's the same thing, non-volatile.
Yeah, non-volatile, slower to write than read, but you can write, rewrite. And it never, as far as I could tell, went anywhere.
The Zenith Z100, I don't know if that was a CPM. I'm trying to figure out which are CPM boxes here, which are Commodore operating systems. And of course, there's the PET 4032 with the keyboard that can be used by adults.
Oh. Yeah. Nonsense.
So the beige invasion. And then this room. It does get toasty hot up here, but it stays dry. I take the systems and put them in the dry rooms to winter over so they're really preserved. But so the ones down in that lower room, I move.
Oh.
I move in about November. But
how much does it cost to dehumidify?
Too
expensive.
It's too expensive. And these have done well for some of them for 10 years now or 8 years. They've done very well. So this is Windows versus everything. This is the 1980s, the OS wars, the platform wars, Unix, Mac, various, DOS compatibility for Macintosh. And of course, Microsoft's over here writing all the applications for the Mac.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the Microsoft world, and Bill Gates unplugged and trying to be Van Halen. And the Windows 95 launch, and that was the day I established my company.
Windows 95. I remember one of the magazines talking about version numbers and market penetration.
Mm-hmm.
Windows 95 OS 3 were the versions that came out at the same time. OS 2, 3%.
OS 2, 3%. Yeah.
Version 3 came.
So
apparently it was a better system.
So Microsoft's first mouse.
For the market.
With a steel ball moved back under from where Xerox had figured out If the pickup, whether it be optical or a ball, was under the fingertip, you associated your fingertip with the cursor.
Better.
Everybody moved it back here without even thinking. So you have
the
generator.
Unless you change the angle of the thing, it doesn't make a lot of difference.
Yeah, and then you have the generations of mice that came since.
You know, and then they turned, they got a twist in them.
They got a twist in them.
So they were only best for right-handed people, I think.
And this is what I wrote in the 80s. I wrote a graphical operating system.
Okay.
Now, here's an interesting story for you. This is what got me hooked into all this history. I came out of University of Southern California with a master's degree, got hired by this tiny company. I had seen the Xerox Star in 1981 on the cover of a magazine when I was on the PP11,
mm-hmm.
and thought, if computers are going to look like that with, you know, with windows and icons and stuff, I'm going to go into this thing. So I decided to go in, and then in 1987, I graduated, and I went to work for this small company that was developing GUIs based on the Three Rivers PERC, but for the IBM PC-AT platform, with a custom card and a Sigma-designed screen, very high-res screen, even by today's standards. And I got hooked, and I joined the company. And
that's right. That's something at 200 pixels vertically.
And this actually... Well, the Hercules. Well, this screen down here is a Sigma, which is 1600 by 1200, circa 1988,
mm-hmm.
very high res. And so I wrote all this, and we took GEM from Digital Research, didn't use almost anything in the GUI, and then I wrote the direct pull down menus, everything. I wrote a font editor, graphics editor, desktop,
mm-hmm.
and we already had a form designer. Drawing program, and then converters, you could drag and drop onto the little converters and convert to, you could drag and drop to the trash. And the Mac had been out, and the Xerox, this is emulating the Xerox look and feel. The Xerox was selling our products.
They were selling your products.
Yeah, we were a little startup, but Xerox had taken our products and were marketing them worldwide
mm-hmm.
By 1988. This is in 88. And so I'm one of the last humans alive that got to build from scratch a GUI system. And that's where I got interested in where did graphical interfaces come from, and about the Alto, and I had access to the original people at Xerox.
I think you're saying you expanded a wider range probably than a lot of developers.
Yeah, because I wrote three complete shipping products mm-hmm. in 2.5 years.
Wow.
Including the base graphic layer and everything. I wrote all the libraries. Mm-hmm. 2.5, 3 years that were all shipping.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved to Czechoslovakia in 1990-91 to hire the Czechs who would take over my code and port it to Windows 3.0.
Mm-hmm.
And Windows 3.0 was just like you, that's where my programming kind of ended around that period. I wrote some C++ later just for fun
mm-hmm.
for another project. But so I got interested in where did GUIs come from, and then I learned about PARC and the Alto and all the other GUI-based systems, and that's what started my passion for this project.
That's all the stuff I wrote for graphics. I used somebody else's library.
Yeah.
For the operating system.
And I had to pretty much...
I guess the Xerox was selling it, but they had some applications that used the same GUI.
Well, what they had was they had huge sites. I mean, they would have like AT&T would use their laser printers, massive, you know, $500,000 laser printers to print all the billing.
Mm-hmm.
They had the Xerox Star workstations in the next room, but they couldn't develop designs there for the printers because they would use Interpress, which couldn't be interpreted at full speed. So the engineer, the developers of all those high, they're called electronic documents or high speed, precursor to the web, really, mm-hmm. they would sit at the console of the machine and type in the basic commands. It was almost like engineering level commands. To write their line draws and boxes and put mm-hmm. the text and choose the font.
Mm-hmm.
And so our software did all that and then generated that templates for them to then merge their data.
And you're saying the Star would do that, but it printed with an interpreter that wasn't fast enough?
Yeah, the Star would do that, but the Star division never talked to the printing system division very well. So Interpress, mm-hmm. which came out of the Star, was unusable.
It was too much processing and print time.
It was too elaborate. And out of Interpress came Adobe and PostScript, because mm-hmm. those two guys quit. Geschke and Warnock quit Xerox. In fact, I just met the lady, Juliana Lavendel, who did the exit interview for both of them. Anyway, so this runs the Elixir desktop, and this is This is the big desktop publishing machine, the Mac SE with a Canon LaserWriter, so I put that there. And then portability. The
Wait, was Elixir what this was?
Elixir is this was, and this will run under DOS on this machine.
Okay.
With pull-down menus and stuff. I could fire it up if you're interested.
Okay.
But I'm more interested in seeing your stuff fired up.
Okay, yeah, which we will need to. I think we're good, but we'll need to schedule.
Yeah, we should. We'll get through the tour here pretty short. The portability, just recently redone, polished all the machines up. But you've got the original Data General 1 with the unreadable LCD, but the first full-size LCD on a laptop.
Oh, and is that the one that was an IBM PC?
No, this is an original. Oh, yeah, it was PC compatible.
Data General made one of those that was PC compatible before IBM made one, as I remember.
Oh,
and two floppies in the side.
Oh, yes.
But I don't remember what it was.
Yes, it is. There's the two floppies. Yeah, absolutely. Everybody was at IBM at that point in terms of coming out with cool products. Oh, here's...
Yeah,
here's,
but the reason it was successful is that it ran IBM software.
Right, it was compatible. You're saying a Trash 80 Model 100, so here's another Trash 80.
Sure enough, they're all here. So I didn't realize they kept calling them 80s.
And they did until, and then the name was lost, and they started calling just Tandy at a certain point. Around 1982, 83, then the name was lost. But these were, you could run this for a couple of days on 4 AA batteries, and you could dial in, and you could modem in.
Mm-hmm.
So journalists use these at, like, baseball games and stuff, just sitting there. Tandy. Amazing machine.
And it had some amount of RAM in it, and that was all.
Yeah.
But it had files and RAM.
And files and word processing, and yeah, no, it was a perfect machine for what it did. And here's some more K-Pro Osborne combos. And here's, remember we saw the Data General Nova. This is the Nova 16-core stack, core memory stack called a mattress. I guess it made sense.
Mattress because it folds over and so.
Partly because I think of that, and because of it's like a sprung thing with the donuts and the wires through the donuts. It's almost like springs.
Yeah, well, it's a core memory.
It's a core memory. But I always ask people, what's behind this door, and most people can't guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, various parts, comptometer coming apart, the Wolverine toy adding machine, the comptometer being torn apart, a punch card printer, printing cylinder, printing an actuarial card, an IBM card, rolls them out one after another. Cool thing.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a galvanic skin response system for stress testing people using the,
okay.
Didn't quite work, using the Apple II to calm people down. GSR.
Maybe you talk at them and see what calms them, but...
That's right, you contract.
CSR, or do you use it as a lie detector?
Use it as a lie detector.
A lie detector.
And the Sinclair Spectrum from the UK, and then, of course, these famous things where if your little brother wobbled this while you were programming, you lost everything. Why not?
Okay.
And every home at that time must have had a shelf of boxes like this. And, of course, the famous Fairchild Channel F, which had video carts, which this is the first removable cartridge video game system. And as soon as this came out in 76, everyone stopped all their projects, Atari, everybody, because they just changed the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And this failed, but everybody else switched to removable game media. Computer tennis shoes for the Apple, pedometers for the Apple II, falling apart.
Mm-hmm. The data could be taken with the Apple II.
The data could be taken with the Apple II. And the Hacker's Quarterly. And now let's go downstairs. Ouija board for the Macintosh or Lisa XL. You know, move your getting from the ether. Oops. I'll put you in the dark. This is a little bit steep because this was a hayloft up here. So it's... But down here we have some total things of heart's delight. We have over in the corner, sitting in the corner of the ring is...
Oh, your Cray.
That's our Cray.
Now you don't carry that upstairs every winter, do you?
It has never... Well, 2 years ago, Ken Summerall from the big museum came over and we used the crowbar for 6 hours to line up the bolt plates on three transformers so we could tie it to the processor tower so that when the next big earthquake comes, this will not walk off that pallet. So now it is tied in there, there, and there, and that's enough to lock us. These are oil-filled, and they're 600 pounds apiece. So, but now this is a solid.
The power supplies?
Yeah.
It's not, it's in those.
Transformers. The power supply consists of, that's the transformer power distribution cabinet, where you can set the voltages, and then somewhere else is a large diesel generator set that's the power, actual power generating station. Oh. And usually all of that, you had to have a subfloor that was human walkable underneath.
The doors are on the diesel generator?
Yeah, so the putting out 483 phase or something like that.
Okay, and, so they didn't run on a motor generator when the line was up?
The government tended, I think they tended to run them strictly on the generators. And that's why the consumable costs are so high for these things. Mm-hmm. And then you need a refrigeration unit, a separate refrigeration unit to drive Freon to chill, in this case, water. This is water-cooled.
This one's water.
It's water-cooled. And here's a typical dual-sided board. Feel how heavy that is. And the genius of Seymour Cray is figuring out how to surface mount all these chips on this copper plate, which is a cold plate.
Yeah, that's heat conduction, presumably.
Heat conduction right out through these Star Trek fin-like channels. Think back to Trek episodes. Think Nomad. Remember the floating Nomad that was this robot that came aboard above the transporter and just floating around? It had this shape.
There are a lot of episodes I haven't seen.
Well, this looks like the warp core combined with Nomad combined with the seats on the bridge. And Seymour Cray was a serious Trek fan, so when he formed his company, he wanted to make something look like Trek, and it does. So there you have it. And we have pieces of serial. This is serial number 38. We have chunks of serial number 34 and number 70. I'll get a picture of you in or on the tray, whatever you choose. The serial numbers, they made about 71 or 72 of them.
But I never saw before that power distribution panel.
Yeah, in fact, those, there's only two of them left. One is here, and one of them is in a museum in Germany.
Yeah, because there aren't any in Mountain View that I saw.
No.
Two or three Crays.
Yeah, they've got serial number, they've got two Cray 1s and a Cray 2. And I've got a Cray 1 and a prototype of the Cray 2 and this cabinet and a whole bunch of parts, including part of the Cray 3.
This is something you're not likely to be firing up.
No, it's pretty chopped up. By the way, that's
you may not have enough power coming in.
That's a chip from the connection machine, which was, that big black cube with all the flashing lights on it. It was a multiprocessor. That's a single chip from it. I'm looking for the whole thing. If you see one on the street, give me a call with a sign saying free on it. That's the same thing, but packaged down to where these individual things are the vector boards. And then you can see that's the Cray 3 from about 1993, 94 time frame. So that's the miniaturization from the Cray 1 of 76.
Each one of those is a processor?
Each one of those is like one of these boards.
Okay.
That's what my understanding is. And this was immersed in fluorinert coolant. In fact, where's the picture of Seymour? Yeah, there's Seymour. Oh, there he is leaning on that's the fish tank with the Cray 3 in it. Okay, so the Cray 3. And, the fellow.
Is Cray out of business?
They're owned by Silicon Graphics, actually.
Oh,
and they're still.
Silicon Graphics is.
This man died 3 days ago, George Michael. Mm-hmm. And he was the man at Los Alamos who wrote all the test routines to test this machine for Los Alamos. He was at Livermore. And this is the evaluation report that the government evaluated the performance of this thing. Look at this. Days into evaluation, mean time to failure. So, 58 days in. They're getting some pretty good reliability in the hours. Only 7 hours. So this allowed them to say, okay, we'll buy this machine. Because they had bought...
Is that a full failure or some kind of failure?
Some kind of failure, I think.
Presumably, if it's one of many processors that fail, they can reconfigure and keep going slower.
Yeah. Yeah, because This is actually a vector machine, so it's basically a vector pipeline. So presumably if you lost part of your vector, you weren't getting good calculations.
Yeah.
That is the process.
Unless you change the mapping.
Then you change the mapping. You could just sort of outbank something. So that's a Cray XMP board. See, these tabs are different. And this is for a Cray YMP, this is a memory interchange module. And this is one of the largest S100 computers ever built.
Okay.
With these special God bout bus terminators that would allow you to extend the single S100 bus over 5 bays.
Especially as I remember bus termination was an issue.
And this one,
you could get bus terminators on the aftermarket. It really is S100.
And it ran with 10 68,000 boards.
Okay.
As a multiprocessor development environment. Isn't that weird? And the fellow who designed it claims that it was used to optimize garbage truck routes at one point.
Okay.
Over in the peninsula.
I guess that's like doing school buses, but hurt.
So there's your, and these were made, I think, specially by Godbout.
Especially for this thing. There was a bus termination issue, because Cromemco or somebody made them bus terminators early on, and IMSI always insisted they were unnecessary and didn't put it on their motherboard. But then when they went to the 8085, which ran at 3 megahertz instead of 2, they found it was necessary. And the one I have has a bus terminator on the motherboard.
Okay. Do you ever use the Wonder Bus, that fairly long bus extender?
No.
Yeah, okay.
No, I use the computers to program, not to
right,
the
not
hardware.
To not to build up.
That meant I had to find bad memory boards in the middle of the night and replace them a lot, because they weren't very reliable.
And you had to write to lower common denominators, too, on the machines.
Yeah, I chose to write for the 88, even though my machine has an 8085.
Gotcha.
Which wasn't much different.
Yeah.
Calling it an 8085 was a marketing thing.
Right.
Because an 8086 was a very different machine. And they were trying to push something that would go into older designs and add a little something to them. Sounded a lot better.
I remember the 8085 used at projects at Xerox. I remember Intel begging Xerox not to use 8085s anymore because they were shutting down manufacturing.
Oh, there was something that didn't go?
Yeah.
And they just let that market go to Z80?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, somebody took
people
over.
People didn't want to go to, or 8088.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted an 8-bit hardware and a new instruction set, you went to an 8088 if you wanted to. The old instruction sets, you went to the Z80.
And this is about the time I was born, 1962, EAI, Electronic Associates Inc., was building these analog systems. Mm-hmm. And there's your program right here.
Yeah.
And then you would, and I took this board off, and I can't get it back on, so I'm waiting for somebody who actually programmed one of these to give me a full demo. But this supposedly, I guess, was that's your code. And then you somehow
the board was changeable.
Changeable, yeah. They had these stacked up, and individual modules were changeable. So these
yeah, you could have a board for your project.
Yeah.
And when your time slice and thing ended, you could put your board away.
I thought I'd put the patch cords in a frisbee. Yeah. So analog. This is my vote to analog computing.
Yes. What I remember those were good for is if you write something that moves in two dimensions like a screensaver does.
Right.
And you put it into a plotter, you can print wall decorations.
Right.
Equations that gradually damped.
Gradually damped.
You know, I'm not sure if I have that anymore, but you know what pisses me off? About 2 years, I used to have a paper tape for a PDB-1, and I think I threw it away about 2 years ago.
Oh.
Now I could turn it up at the...
You turn up at the apartment.
No, thank you. I could turn up at the computer museum and see if my version of Space War runs in your machine.
Right. Or Maze War. Or Space War. Space War.
Yeah. I don't know if the port numbers and all were the same.
Well,
was fixed. If it was, it should run.
When their PDB-1 came back up, they read the memory out, and the memory, of course, was perfectly preserved in their PDB-1, including the error that had been written in the log 30, 40 years before when they shut it down for the last time, it was still there. It was exactly the, and they were able to read out the memory. And I think it had, well, it had a number of things that they needed. So they have dumped the memory right away.
Oh, they actually got some programs out of it that didn't otherwise have a record of?
I think Snowflake, which was this incredible wall pattern generator, Snowflake might have come out of that that dump. Now, here's your Mac Cube. And this is the various shapes and sizes of stuff Apple has done over the years. It's just sort of mind-boggling. These are Tempest Macs for military and spy use. Mm-hmm. They're modified for removable drives, things like that.
Looks like some kind of incredible shielding.
Yeah, that's Tempest Tempest style copper coils. And it's inside this copper sheeting in this there. And here's your special connector. And of course, there's a guy here who said, oh, this is pure government. He had been a tester for Tempest. He said, that's one contractor, that's another, and they're not working together, so the whole system's compromised. Your government at work. Now, in here, this is almost at the end, is the pride and joy of the link. So, Elements, recognize this from the PDP series?
Yes, I have a deck tape at home.
You have a deck tape at home? It will work on here. It won't run, but it's readable. The data would be, you could format it and do something else with it. So, deck tape, the modules, there's a whole bunch of extras. These are deck modules.
Yeah, system modules there with the metal thing around the edge.
There you are.
And as you can see, it, there's transistors, not integrated circuits.
Yeah, pull it out and take a look.
See?
Yeah, transistors.
So look at them, there's three pins in each one of those little cans.
So hold that one up. So you worked on, did you work on a system that used?
As a programmer, yes.
Okay.
Sure. I worked on PDP-1. That was my first job programming
PDP-1. PDP-1. Yeah. I'll get a better shot of you with the entire link.
So
here are the signatures of
time shared PDP-1 in 1965.
Oh, that's interesting. Somebody.
Yes. They hired a whole bunch of MIT students.
Oh, okay.
And who had timeshared the first PDP-1? At King's BBN, they timeshared another one.
Oh, wow.
But,
so, Wes Clark, not
that wasn't
the
one, that
general.
That was a different PDP-1 than the one I played Space War on.
What I like about this is notice it's the same look and feel of the Altair, the same, same aluminum frame here. Same kind of bluish box, color. Oh, this is wood. This is plywood. Can you take a look at the nick out of this? And that's Wes Clark, not the general, he keeps saying. And these are all the original designers, programmers, techs on the Link project. And that's 2 kilowords. And this plugs into a regular 110 outlet, draws 18 amps.
This is 2,000 words?
2,000 words.
Of how many bits?
I think it's 16.
Okay.
And,
wait a minute.
Maybe it's 32-bit words.
It was more than that, actually. But 32-bit wasn't a used number much then.
It seems
to me, until the 360, they came up with addressing it in 8-bit units and using multiples for word size.
That's a book that talks a lot about the link. And look at that thing of beauty. And this thing was stored in the garage.
Remember, it was a 4K word core bank. The core itself was a little thing. I don't know how much the electronics to drive it was. But.
So one of these links literally was in a private home, Mary Ellen Wilkes' home. Four of these survived in Scott Robinson's garage in St. Louis, and that was our source for getting this one working here. And they're getting another one.
So is this the actual processor for the link?
This is it. Yeah.
Okay, so when you show a photo of this, this isn't actually the link.
This isn't actually the link.
You have to have this in the closet or something.
Right. Or at the bottom of the stairs in which Mary Ellen had. And so this will power up and is usable instantly. So it'll load the operating system. I've done it myself. And the one time we did it, it took 90 minutes to warm up. Another time it came up right away. This is Scott Robinson, who saved these links. That's his $3 bill And his payment for saving a couple of inks for this history event, this restoration we did.
Mm-hmm.
And Gordon Bell was really pushed this. Originally, the Computer History Museum was invited to be a partner in it, and the then director, the former director, rejected the project. Gordon Bell blew his top.
Mm-hmm.
And Gordon decided, because I had set up the project with Severo Ornstein. And Gordon, so we had offered the museum, they said no. And so we took it on. And we held the event at the museum at the Vintage Computer Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And all the museum people came because mm-hmm. it's of great interest. But this is currently the only working link in the world. And
the things that were going on.
Oh, here's your Altos.
I went to elementary school a few miles from Lincoln Lab.
Okay.
Lincoln Lab is in Lincoln, Massachusetts, which
right.
is where my family lived. Actually, until almost 1990.
MPM. This is the machine that ran MPM, the Altos. So you can mm-hmm. ask you all about that.
Mm-hmm.
But and this is the winter over room for a lot of those things in the lineage room, just to keep things nice and safe. And they are.
Because we're on the sunny side here.
Yeah, this is dry. The temperature tends to be about constant, even in the winter. It's never.
We're not quite on the ground, I guess.
Not on the ground. When and if, which I'm sure I will at some point, get the funds, I'm going to raise floor this entire thing, mm-hmm. and then seal in the entire front and just do all the construction.
Ventilate underneath, I suppose.
Ventilate underneath, yeah. Because this was a cider press barn for pressing cider apples. And that's why they have this drain down the center.
Oh, and let it spill a lot. So are there still a lot of apple trees there?
There's a few old ones. I planted a whole bunch of new ones. Let's turn this off so I don't forget. There is some more things. On the left, there's some apple clones, wannabes. An original Wang. Before Wang made word processors, they made scientific computing systems, and this is one of them. They were cassette-based. They were TTL. Mm-hmm. That's a Wang 30. That's very early. And, of course, it uses Selectric as a printer. And there it is, the DEC Robin. It was basically a VT-180 with a CPM built into it and ran CPM. It was used by employees mm-hmm. on their desks. The Zorba, a bizarre CPM system. And a few more donations. But also, this is of a cool nature. Well, that's a Kurzweil 4000 optical character recognition system sold by Xerox. Okay. And I know Ray Kurzweil, actually, and he said, we don't even have one of those in our museum. And this, try to lift this. This is the coolant. It's heavy. It's much heavier than water.
And it looks like it's maybe 2 or 3 gallons.
Yeah.
It's as heavy as my 5-gallon gas can.
Yeah, exactly. And so the Cray 2... This, we didn't know what this was for the longest time. I bought it. The guy that had that Cray 1,
mm-hmm.
I bought that, and I got this sort of thrown in. And no one at the Computer Museum knew what it was. And then I got a call from a guy in Minneapolis saying, you don't know what that is? That's the Cray Q2. That's the prototype for the Cray 2. And we ran this at our supercomputing center, and here's a picture of it. And mm-hmm. it was the first supercomputer run over the Internet. So it was set up to run jobs over the Internet. So it started the whole trend of
okay.
all supercomputers are addressed through the net now. And, of course, you'll notice the non-stainless steel parts. And Seymour always used non-corrosive parts. But this was a prototype unit, so they were bolting it. Didn't bother. And so this was filled with fluorinert, including those transformer power units filled up.
Mm-hmm.
And he flew out here and gave a full tour, and I got an audio interview with him about this machine, and so now the story is told. That's a sign from a regular Cray 2, but I thought I'd just put it on there. Cray 2s are very hard to come by, but this is more hard to come by.
Yeah, that was only one, I guess.
Only one ever made. And a fellow just sent this. He worked at General Motors, and this is their Sinclair training, computer training system for General Motors employees in a briefcase. That just came in. It's really cool.
Oh, okay, so this is something a little like the Tamek Sinclair?
Yeah, it actually is. It's a Sinclair 1500, which is a little bit more beefy, but with a chiclet keyboard. And
specially labeled cassette recorder. Well, no, it isn't even
the
specially generic. Labeled.
And another generous donor sent this Mega ST30. which is a very beefy story about that. And then this Magnavox Odyssey, which they're so cool. They're so these are like from 2001, A Space Odyssey. You know, the design of them, and it's got these templates that you place over your screen. But actually, let's lift up the whole thing. The Odyssey. This is one of the first console game systems, and this is what they looked like. So you put your
a template rather than being able to paint its background graphics.
That's right, and you actually put these cards in here, but they didn't contain the game. They actually just were switches, like card one, card. It just switched the internal electronics of the game, and there's your paddles. I'm gonna put this into a proper display pretty soon, at some point. There's so much to do. There are a lot of these around. This is somebody bought for $12 at a yard sale. And Galen's Chachka wall with things, classics like Tetris, the Soviet Challenge, and of course the Silicon Valley Guy Handbook. And in here, this fellow turns out to be the uncle of somebody who visited the museum a few years ago. There's his girl. She's in there too. Oh, look, I like this. This is what you weren't doing. Look at all the A&W beer and Coke cans up on the walls.
Oh.
That's his office, of course. Coke, Pepsi.
Coke, yeah. Somehow I went for coffee.
Yeah, you got started on a healthier, actually a relatively healthier habit than Coke. Oh, yeah. So the Chachka wall. So I would suggest we go retire back to the house and have another cold drink,
mm-hmm.
and then do phase two. What do you think?
Okay.
Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So that's the $2, $5, $10 tour.
Okay.